situated. All right. Our clerk will announce counsel on our second case, which is Columbia Lloyds Insurance Company versus Robert Mao and Vachana Mao.
May it please the court, Mr. Nathan Chapman to argue for appellant and Mr. Robert Grisham to argue for the appellee.
Mr. Chapman.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, I'm here on behalf of Columbia Lloyds. And this case was an unusual one for me because I think it's the first time my reply brief's ever been longer than my initial brief. And that's because both sides are appealing the decision of the trial court to you. This case is about an insurance claim for damage to rental property. And Judge McGrath found that my client breached the insurance contract by denying coverage, but found that that denial was not in bad faith. He reached both conclusions as a matter of law, and on cross motions for summary judgment ruled partially for my client, partially for the Mouse. He did not award attorney's fees. And those are basically the three issues before the court today. Was there a breach of contract? Was it in bad faith? And what do we do about attorney's fees? Now, our submission is that there was no breach of contract, so the other two questions don't need to be addressed. And the reason there was no breach of contract is, as with most insurance policies, odds are everybody in this courtroom's got the same clause in theirs at home. This policy had what's called a vacancy clause. And a vacancy clause is where, when the house is vacant for more than 60 days, the policy is suspended. It's perfectly standard. They're in every insurance policy for a very particular reason, and it is the state-approved language. The policy behind the language in the policy is vacant houses are more at risk for damage from vandalism, fire, water leaks, hail knocks a couple of shingles loose and rats get in, whatever it may be. And in order to insure a vacant house, a higher premium is appropriate. And that risk, instead of everybody paying slightly higher premiums, is borne by the relatively few people who have to say, well, this house is going to be vacant, I need to insure it, and they buy what's called a floater to cover the period of vacancy. You can have vacant houses in any number of circumstances. For example, a person in a nursing home may still own their house, may not live in it, none of their family members live in it. It's vacant. And they may want to return to it someday. Depending upon their health, they may or may not. It's not an abandoned property, but it is currently unoccupied, and it is vacant, even if they leave their furnishings in it. Summer homes, beach houses, lake houses, all the same way. They may have furniture. They may have utilities. But what they don't have is a person living in them. Now, in this particular case, It's approved by Texas. The concept is standardized nationwide. It would be in Crouch on Insurance. But in any given state, the number of days required to trigger the vacancy clauses and policies will vary slightly. The exact phrasing of the language will vary slightly.
I was curious because it looks like we don't have any Texas case that's exactly squarely on point. We have a few that are close in some ways and a few that are close in different ways, but I was wondering if research from across the nation would be helpful if this is a standard type provision. I know sometimes the insurance policies are standardized kind of nationwide.
Well, Crouch on Insurance would be the nationwide equivalent of Williston on contracts or Wigmore on evidence for this situation. That would be the treatise to look towards. And I think there it's pretty clear, as we've illustrated in the brief, that vacancy really turns on the common use of the word and common sense in the facts of a particular case. And the facts of a case can eliminate the possibility of arguing a house was vacant. For example, I'm going home tonight to my house. I might not be there right now, but it's not vacant. On the other hand, when you have a house which has no utilities, no furniture, and it's a rental property, So you can distinguish, say, the Knopf case, which involves the person's own home. It's vacant. Now, the Knopf case is a pretty good illustration. While it's not a spotted dog, as Your Honor observes, that's a person's house. He has to move out to have extensive renovation and repairs done to it. He does sleep in it at least once a week, and a lot of his furniture is still there. He intends for that to be his house. In contrast with the mouse, there's not a stick of furniture in the place. The utilities aren't turned on. The last renters to use it left more than 120 days before the fire. Some repair work is done to the house, but that repair work ends more than 100 days before the fire.
There seemed to be a fact issue on that. Is that what
you
were going to say?
Yes, Your Honor, but the fact issue was irrelevant because of two things. Even if you assume that the changed testimony supports a longer period of repairs, there was still a 60-day vacancy. And this, again, was a rental property. And the salient fact in Knopf, which could permit a fact issue, was the subjective intent of the property owner to return to the property and occupy it. There is no indication of that in Mao. The Maos don't live at the property. They've never testified or submitted any evidence they intend to live at the property. And they also did not submit any evidence that they were actively trying to rent the property at the time of the fire. If they'd said, we have a person moving in next week, and presented that evidence to Judge McGrath, that probably would be a fact issue of intent under Knopf. But it's not, because they didn't present that evidence. Now, the other factor of this that's important, as you pointed out with the fact issue, or attempt to create a fact issue, is we have the story the Maos are telling Columbia Lloyds at the time it makes its claim determination. We don't live there. Nobody lived there. Yes, it was vacant. And they say that in their examination under oath, which is part of the investigative process. The house was vacant, period. How long it had been unoccupied and vacant? 100 days or so, more than 60 days. So that's the information Columbia Lloyds has when it makes the claim determination. Well, it was vacant. Policy was suspended. There is no coverage. Yes, Your Honor.
And it says we're dealing with a definition of a dwelling under coverage A on page 107 of the agreement. And paragraph number 5 talks about other structures on the described location set apart by the dwelling by clear space. Include structures connected by only a fence, utility line, or similar connection. What was the evidence about the connection of the main part of the house to the garage?
The garage was a detached garage, so the evidence was there was no connection in terms of a physical structure.
No utility line or no fence.
I do not believe there's any reference to that in the record, Your Honor. So we have a detached garage, which has some stuff in storage in it, but it's not being used to support habitation. An old refrigerator, an unplugged refrigerator or stove. If the standard for vacancy is, as long as there's a refrigerator in your detached garage, even if it's unplugged and no one's using it, the building can't be vacant, then the vacancy clause is a nullity. Every landlord could simply keep a stash of old refrigerators around and park them in garages. We have to look beyond that. Yes, Your Honor.
Then I'm concerned that we're not reaching too far afield to determine that if the garage is being used for storage of tenant furniture, and it is in any way connected to the main dwelling, that the vacancy clause applies, giving strict interpretation to the language in the policy for the benefit of the insurance company, as we were instructed to do in Crouch.
Your Honor, first off, I would point out it's a detached garage, so we don't have the connection issue. Second, the stuff that was stored in the garage was stuff intended, well, there were two sets of stuff. We'll stick with stuff. There were some boxes of clothes abandoned by the prior tenants who had no intention of returning to the property as residents. So other stuff got put in the garage. Fair enough. And it was stuff the Mows moved in of their own with, at least as they're telling Columbia Lloyds, when the claim determination is being made, they had no intention to use on the rental property. They were using that garage as off-site storage for their own house, which is a completely different piece of property. So I believe so. And the examinations under oath of Ms. Mao, they refer to it as their possessions, not stuff for the rental house. But again, if it comes down to that final point, while Columbia Lloyds may have been incorrect, what they were not doing was acting in bad faith. And Judge McGrath rightly followed the controlling case law in Texas that bad faith requires more than simply the failure to pay the insurance contract. It requires, as Judge Crowley, Judge Hill, Judge Street used to say these things, somebody's trying to rookie do somebody. There's no evidence of that here. Columbia Lloyds had the facts given to it by its insured and made a decision. Didn't lie, it didn't cheat, and it did it in a timely fashion. Now, one of the elements on the cross appeal is also the denial of the prompt payment of claims claim brought by the plaintiffs. And in the Russell case, the Court of Appeals makes it very clear. The Prompt Payment of Claims Act is to encourage a decision be made quickly, right or wrong. And in the Russell case, while the decision was incorrect, there was ample evidence that the insurance company had delayed making its decision well past the time periods permitted under the Prompt Payment of Claims Act. And that was what resulted in the award to the plaintiff, not the mere fact that a denial was found out to have been incorrect. So the prompt payment claim issue raised by the appellee cross appellants was correctly decided by Judge McGrath. They do not prevail on that point. And that leaves the attorney's fees issue. And I'll admit that's a sticky one. There are several theories that were brought which could support an award of attorney's fees. Two of them, the DTPA bad faith claims and the Prompt Payment of Claims Act, the plaintiffs did not win on the merits, so you wouldn't reach that question. The third was a breach of contract claim. Judge McGrath entered a summary judgment in their favor on the merits on breach of contract. But there's no award of attorney's fees. The plaintiffs wanted a jury trial. Judge McGrath gave them every opportunity to cure defects in their record, to prove that they were entitled to attorney's fees, and to present evidence of the amount. As a trial judge in Texas, he is entitled to take judicial notice of what are reasonable and necessary attorney's fees and spare a jury a 2 or 3 day trial. The plaintiffs refused to do that. They cannot show a bill of review to show what their damages would have been. It's harmless error. They did not meet the statutory prerequisites for recovery of attorney's fees under 38001 because they have not brought evidence to this court of a compliant demand letter. The lawsuit itself is insufficient. So that point should also not result in a reversal of this case. It is an uncomfortable fact, but it was the correct decision. They did not present competent evidence of attorney's fees and should not prevail on that issue. And I'll return the balance of my time. It's probably only a minute or two, but I'd like to.
Question.
Sure.
On the breach of contract issue, if I heard you correctly, you indicated that in determining whether the trial court correctly granted summary judgment, we should consider only what was known to Columbia at the time it made the decision to deny the claim based on the vacancy clause. Is that incorrect?
Yes, Your Honor. That is what I would say for the bad faith claims. Okay. For bad faith, it's what they knew it, when they did it.
Okay, so if it's not that for breach of contract, then how does Mrs. Mao's affidavit not at least create a fact issue? Because she did say that the utilities were on, and she did say that she was going by there and checking every week, and I believe there's a dispute as to how long, whether the repairs bumped up within the 60-day period before the fire or not.
I think that's where we look at Knopf, Your Honor. If we look at Knopf, it's the intent to reoccupy that's the turning point, that the guy intends to move back into his house. Ms. Mao never had that intent, and she never presented any intent of actively trying to rent the property during that period. So it was vacant. Now, the other side of that is, if you're correct and it is a fact issue, I don't get a reverse and render. I get a reverse and remand, which is the alternative relief we pled for. But I do believe reverse and render in favor of Columbia Lloyds is the proper result. Thank you.
May it please the court. I think one of the things we need to look at first would be the definition of vacancy. Starting in 1915, Southern National versus Cobb San Antonio opinion, the court defined vacancy as entire abandonment of the property, deprived of contents, empty. That opinion was followed in 1940 by Phoenix Assurance versus Shepherd. That opinion was approved by the Texas Supreme Court. The court adopted the same definition and also recognized that vacant and unoccupied are not synonymous. And that's really our taking throughout the underlying case as well as the appeal, is that vacancy and unoccupied are the same thing. If we take a look at the Knopf opinion, the court explains, takes the definition of entire abandonment, deprived of contents, empty, adds to it without contents of substantial utility, and then goes into, on page 501 of the opinion, the explanation of what substantial utility is, and that would be the value of the property to the owner, not the value on the free market, if you will. And what we know in this case is that we have undisputed evidence from Mrs. Mao that there was a refrigerator, a washer, dryer, dishwasher in the home, appliances, a sofa, heater, bed, second refrigerator, a range in the garage. That was undisputed. And the contractor, Valentin Leos, confirmed that there was a refrigerator, washer, dryer, dishwasher, and stove in the house. Most importantly, the adjuster, Judy Romero, admitted that there was no intent to abandon the property. And if we take a look at the cases cited by the appellant, Farmers versus Wright, that's distinguishable because we had an unoccupied property clause. And the court asked initially, I think one of the first questions was whether or not the vacancy clause is a standard clause, and it is in a dwelling policy. However, some policies, homeowners policies and other policies, actually give a specific definition for vacancy. We don't have that in this case, so therefore we must look to Texas case law for that. And quite often, vacancy is defined as being unoccupied. So it's similar to the definition given in the Farmers versus Wright case, which is, I think, distinguishable from our case. Likewise, in the Jerry versus Kentucky and Central Insurance case out of Houston and the Lynn versus USAA case, the courts found that those properties were abandoned because we had evidence that the utilities were cut off, that there were multiple burglaries, break-ins at the properties. In fact, in the Lynn case out of San Antonio, there was a testimony or evidence that the doors were left unlocked so that vagrants wouldn't break out the windows.
But and the vacancy doesn't, I think that one side is trying to say vacancy equates unoccupied, but the other side is trying to say vacancy is equated with abandonment.
Yes, Your
Honor. I don't think it's either one of those. I don't think that vacancy equates with unoccupied, and I also don't think that the only way you can have a vacant building is to have it be abandoned.
Well, we're following the cases, and the case law seems to say that the abandonment is...
That the case law says abandonment when addressing a vacancy.
It actually says entire abandonment. In fact, the Knopf case explains entire abandonment, that is, without contents of substantial utility. And you must prove abandonment because retention of the contents in the house or any contents in the house is evidence of lack of abandonment. That's in Knopf on page 501. And so I think you know, we have undisputed evidence that it wasn't abandoned, and then we have admissions from the adjuster. She, on page 81 of her deposition, which is the record at page 296, admitted we knew they were not abandoning the property. Abandonment is not a question or an issue in this case. And she admitted that the utilities were on because the house was being remodeled. That's not an issue. That's not a fact dispute, in my opinion. So we believe this court can affirm the trial court's judgment and finding as to the breach of contract. We attached an opinion, although it was withdrawn, a 2002 opinion out of this court, Wallace versus USAA. It was a virtually an identical clause, vacancy clause. The property was a rental property. The home was being remodeled. Vacancy was undefined, just as we have in this case. And this court applied the reasoning that we believe is proper and determined that the lack of occupancy doesn't render a property vacant and that the property was not abandoned, relying upon the Knopf case, the Jerry case, and the cases we cited in our brief. I'll turn over at this time to the prompt payment of claims interest, if I may, and distinguish the protective life case. In that case, the property owner only sued the insurance company for failing to timely investigate and process a claim, not for wrongful denial. And the Texas case law is very clear under Higginbotham, Protective Life, Orem, the Teat versus Mutual Life Insurance Company case, and Cater versus USAA, that the wrongful rejection of a claim necessarily means that the insurance company failed to pay the claim within 60 days, imposing liability of 18% per annum and attorney's fees.
So you say you automatically
win? We automatically win on that, yes. Because the claim wasn't paid timely.
So they can't be wrong. They can never be wrong, or else they're subjected to those penalties and attorney's fees.
They can, that's what the cases say, yes. Yes, if it's later determined that their denial was wrongful, even though they did it timely, then they still owe the penalty. The protective life case, again, was based solely on the failing to timely investigate portion of the statute as opposed to the wrongful denial, the 60-day provision in the statute under 542.058. No, we don't, Your Honor. I wish we did, but we don't. Frankly, I think he was. No, I think he was trying to force a settlement. To be frank with you, but we didn't. No, no. Finally, with respect to attorney's fees, under 166A subsection C, a party must state the grounds. Therefore, in the summary judgment, the appellant didn't move on attorney's fees. Judge McGrath, sua sponte, said no attorney's fees. Under the breach of contract claim and the prompt payment of claims act, we're entitled to attorney's fees. So since it wasn't before the court, we believe that's error.
Did you segregate your attorney's fees? Because you had a lot of other counterclaims besides the prompt payment. You had breach of good faith and fair dealing, common law fraud, unfair or deceptive insurance practice.
We didn't present any attorney's fees because it wasn't at issue before the trial court.
Then how can you be awarded attorney's fees if you didn't present any evidence concerning?
Well, the court ruled on attorney's fee, on the attorney's fees without it being in the motion for summary judgment by either side. So there's evidence, and we just weren't able to present that evidence.
Okay.
And finally, with respect to the extra contractual claims, we've pled breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Our claim really goes to whether or not the insurance company acted reasonably. And that the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing under Nicolau, State Farm Lloyds versus Nicolau, can be demonstrated when an insurance company fails to reasonably investigate a claim. The adjuster admitted that everything done after the claim denial, which was about roughly 7 days after the fire, was not a reconsideration. So she took an examination under oath. There was a deposition of the contractor. There was documentation obtained regarding utilities, proving that the utilities were on. All of that was not considered by the insurance company before the denial. And we believe under the Nicolau opinion that supports, or at least raises a fact issue as to whether or not the conduct was reasonable. The breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing is codified at section 541.060, subsection 7, which will be an automatic violation of the DTPA under 1750A4. So we believe the court's finding of no extra contractual liability is an error. With respect to the fraud claims, we do have some evidence of some of the elements, but we would concede that we don't meet all of the elements in our evidence.
In the Walsh case that she attached, the opinion of this court that was withdrawn.
Yes.
In reading this, it does appear to me that that opinion adopted the not definition of vacant and that meant entire abandonment. But then this court went ahead to reverse the summary judgment and say that there was a fact issue on the contract claim.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in our case, we had competing motions for summary judgment would be one thing. We had undisputed evidence that we presented, and we had admissions from the adjuster, Judy Romero, that the property was not abandoned. That would be the difference. And in the Walsh case, I believe it was USAA that was granted summary judgment, and then the homeowner appealed. The homeowner didn't have a summary judgment. That was addressed, yes, Your Honor, yes.
But you just don't believe that that's applicable in this case?
I don't think so. I think we presented evidence that the property was not abandoned, and then under Texas case law that the court's ruling was proper as to breach of contract. Okay, thank you.
Well, first on vacancy. Since 1896, the standard for the meaning of the words vacant and unoccupied is that they should not be taken in a technical and narrow sense, but should be taken in their ordinary sense as commonly used and understood. And if the sense in which they are used are uncertain, they should be construed more favorably to the insured. Probably should have put a sick in there because I think the grammar is a little off, but that's the standard. And that's why either we're right and it should be reversed and rendered, or it's a fact question and it should be reversed and remanded, because vacancy is not about abandonment. Abandonment is about giving up your claim of ownership. You quit claim. You abandon your claim to the property. Vacancy is you don't live there. Nobody lives there. So clearly with this rental property, just like a hotel room, it was vacant. And it was vacant for more than 60 days. Just like a fully furnished, equipped utility, everything hotel room would be vacant if nobody rented it for 60 days. The difference is, this isn't part of a large hotel. It's a standalone house. And yes, there is a legal title holder who has not abandoned the property. Ms. Romero was entirely correct in her answer. But what there was a property that was unoccupied by a human being. Nobody lived there. Nobody ate there. Nobody slept there. Nobody raised or fed children there. It was a vacant house. You walk by it now, as you're walking down the street, look in the windows, see there's no furniture, nobody's there. Maybe there's a for rent or for sale sign in the yard. You'd call it a vacant house. That's the common usage. So that addresses the breach of contract issue. Now, on the prompt payment of claims issue, Protective Life Insurance versus Russell is quoted at length in our reply brief. It's probably the longest block quote I've ever done, but I had to, because throughout it are buried some very important sentences. The court repeatedly states things along the lines of, "We must emphasize that PLIC's violation of Article 21.55 was not due to its decision to deny Ms. Russell's claim. Nothing in 21.55 suggests that an insurance company cannot dispute and deny a claim." That's on page 16 of our reply brief. The following some string cites, the decision to deny Mrs. Russell's claim was within PLIC's discretion. However, PLIC did not have the discretion to delay the claims process in the manner it chose, which was to ignore her and eventually send her a denial letter to get her off their backs. You can send a denial letter, but you have to send it within the statutory time periods. That is the basis of the Prompt Payment of Claims Act. It says you have to decide the claim, not how. And I believe Justice Gabriel's point on that was a powerful one. If this is correct, the Prompt Payment of Claims Act is a gotcha for every insurance company that denies a claim based on a substantial factual dispute. They can be wrong. They're just not allowed to be evil. And that's all Columbia Lloyds is saying here. Worst case, we breached the contract because we were wrong, not because we were trying to be evil. And that part of the summary judgment by Judge McGrath should be sustained. On the attorney's fees issue, they didn't offer a bill of review. They didn't include a request for attorney's fees in their motion for new trial. They didn't support that with evidence. They didn't give the trial judge the opportunity to fix the mistake. They've waived their error. And I'll return the balance of my time to the court unless there are any further questions.
Thank you,
Mr. Chapman. Thank you, Your Honor. Have a pleasant day.
Brief 3 or 4 minute recess.